This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And I'm John Loeffler. For the big picture today, we're going to do encore presentations of previous interviews that have been done largely on the Insider Channel, so you get an idea of what happens during the week with all of our subscribers. Ed Easterling will be joining us on market valuations, expected returns, and flawed assumptions. Is the U.S. stock market in a bubble? And given current market valuations, what should investors expect for future returns from the U.S. stock market? And then we'll talk to Gary Schilling, a broadcast originally done from June 9th on the U.S. debt bomb and financial shocks, where he covers his most recent June Insight newsletter on the U.S. debt, government interest costs, and the events that might cause a U.S. debt bomb to explode, and much, much more.
Joining us on the show today is Ed Easterling. He's the founder and president of Crestmont Research, where he develops and publishes insights on long-term stock market returns. And I'm very excited to have you on the show today, Ed. Let's start out with the overall picture when we think about stock market valuations currently. One thing that we've been discussing quite often now on our show is the fact that if you look at Doug Short's average of the four valuation indicators, it shows when we look at the S&P 500 in specific, we're now the second most expensive we've seen going back to, I think that research goes to 1900, with the tech bubble being the highest. So when you look at that, and given your own work, let's say on stock market valuations, do you think the U.S. stock market is in a bubble?
Well, I'm not sure if I'd characterize it in a bubble. I certainly would say that we are above the fair value range. Keep in mind that the Crestmont approach looks at the market as fundamentally driven rather than one of random patterns or random history. So it's fundamentally driven in the sense that we believe that the economy and the inflation rate are the key drivers of the market over time. So as I mentioned, with the inflation rate being the key driver in this low inflation environment, we would expect to have high valuations in stocks and we'd expect to have low interest rates. And that's what we have today. Now, there's a fair value range associated with low inflation, and that would typically be in the low to mid 20s on PE. And today we're in the high 20s. So my perspective would be that we're probably 10 to 20% above the fair value range. So not grossly overvalued, but modestly overvalued, and certainly in the range of vulnerability. I tend to think about the market as a collection of companies, companies that have future cash flows from their earnings, and investors, not all of them are rational, but there is enough of them out there that are rational that if the value of today's market were to move out of line with those expected future cash flows in relation to the level of inflation and expected returns, I think there are enough people that would step away as buyers that it would help the market to correct back to fair value based upon financial principles. All of this, though, needs to get reconciled back to the three key components of stock market returns. And so whenever I talk to analysts that have expectations of secular bull markets or 10% returns for the next decade, what I ask is the reconciliation principle says there are three components to stock market returns: earnings growth, dividend yield, and the change in the valuation level and the change in PE. So what I would ask is, for someone who expects to have strong returns for 10 years, what are the contributions from each of those three components? Today's environment with high valuations, dividend yields are close to 2%. So one of our three components is going to contribute 2 points to returns. Price earnings ratios are fairly high. I think most people don't expect them to increase much from here. So that's not expected to be a major contributor. And matter of fact, most at this point think we're probably a little high and might see a little bit of a reversion there. The last is earnings growth. And earnings growth historically has a very close relationship with economic growth. But that's not a surprise because economic growth is the sales of all companies in the economy, and earnings is essentially the profits of companies in the economy. And there's a strong relationship between profits and sales. So that's one that in a relatively slower growing economy with low inflation, which means nominal growth is lower, that component is unlikely to contribute a substantial number of points to that total return. So I think I would, anytime somebody expects returns more than 4, 5, 6% per year over the next decade, they're probably implicitly expecting an increase in the price earnings ratio back to or above the levels that were realized in the late 90s bubble. And if we do get there, I'll go ahead and agree with you, Chris, that we're in a bubble.
And as you said earlier, you do think we're above the fair value range. I think that much is clear, but you don't think at this point it could quite be characterized as a bubble. But then again, I don't think we can use the 2000 tech bubble as the benchmark. That's something that people have said is we're not in a bubble because if you look at 2000s, we still have a lot of room to grow on the upside. But that's not the benchmark we should use for a bubble, wouldn't you say?
Well, and I think the key reason is what's different between this period today and the late 90s is in the late 90s, and there were people like Greenspan and other prominent economists that expected that the technology boom that we were in would lead to an extended period of 4% plus real growth in the economy. When you have faster growth, that necessarily leads to higher valuations. Higher growth companies typically have higher price earnings ratios. They have faster growing earnings to add to that value. Today, most economists look out and see not even average historical 3% growth. They see something closer to 2 to 2.5%. And over the last 8 years, we've averaged about 2, and that's without a recession baked in. A normal recession expansion period would average something well below 2 if once we go through the next recession. So if we went back to even today we're probably high, but if we went back to a 40-plus price-earnings ratio in an environment of slower growth rather than a euphoric expected higher growth like the late 90s, that would be more than just bubble levels.
Ed, let's talk about how your view on where we are with current market valuations. As you said again earlier, stocks are overvalued. They're not quite in a bubble, according to your view. But when stocks are expensive, of course, as they are now, then expected returns should be lower. Put that into numbers for us. What is the 10-year expected return that you believe investors should be looking at based on current valuations?
Sure. And to do that, let's go back to that reconciliation principle. We know that there are only three sources of return from the stock market: earnings growth, dividend yield, and the change in PE, the change in valuation level. The change in valuation and earnings are what drive capital gains, right? If you buy a stock today, you're implicitly buying it at a certain valuation level, and it has a certain amount of earnings. If the valuation level doesn't change and earnings double over that 10-year period, then your stock price will double. If the valuation level goes up while earnings go up, that has a multiplication effect, and you get well above average capital gains. We've had some periods like the 60s and 70s where aggregate earnings did go up significantly, but valuations came down, and those offset each other and basically left us with almost no capital gains or even sometimes losses. So going forward, I would expect from this level of valuation that we have very little contribution on the upside, maybe some to the downside, from the price-earnings ratio. Dividend yield is 2 points, and if we have average economic growth plus this low inflation rate, we can expect about 4 percentage points from earnings growth. So an investor, and when I speak to groups, I often ask people to raise their hands about whether they expect deflation, inflation, or low stable inflation over the next 10 years. Very few at this point are expecting deflation. I'd say somewhere around a third or so will expect low stable inflation for another 10 years. And the majority are expecting an increase in inflation over that period. If we keep the low stable inflation there, so let's go with the one-third group, that gives us, let's say, 0 to just a little bit of a decline in PE, 2 points on dividends, and 4 points on earnings. So, according to the reconciliation principle, about a 6% compounded annual return over the next decade. Now, that's what I'd call a bear in hibernation, not a secular bear market, because that doesn't have price-earnings ratios coming down. But it doesn't have them going up, and we can't have a secular bull until we can have a doubling or tripling of PE. So, effectively, that's a bear that stays in hibernation. And we end up 10 years from now sitting here on having another discussion saying, well, now that valuation is this high, we're probably expecting the same thing for the next decade. So there's no future for average or above average returns from high valuations. What about that two-thirds group in the room, the people who expect a little higher inflation? Well, the good news is that earnings growth is going to move from maybe 4% to 4.5% or 5%, maybe a little more than that. Dividend yield is still going to stay at 2%, because once your money goes in right now, you're putting it in a 2% dividend yield environment. But your price-earnings ratio, what you'll find is if inflation moves back to average and the price-earnings ratio moves back to average, the historical long-term average, that takes about 6 points or 7 points off of returns. So although we got a little extra benefit to the earnings growth, that multiplier effect of that PE coming down more than offsets that, and we're somewhere in a rising inflation environment with returns over the next decade being close to 0.
Okay, so as you just said, if we were to see low inflation, that would really be corresponding to somewhat of a hibernating bear, as I think you put it, you know, looking at 6% compounded annual return over the next 10 years with current valuations. But again, if we do see higher inflation rates closer to the average, then returns are expected to be 0% over the next 10 years. Did I get that correct?
That's correct. And keep in mind that we've been bringing price-earnings ratios down. That's an environment that's very indicative of what happened back in the late, in the 1960s and 70s, in a rising inflation environment where the market was flat and choppy for almost two decades and ending with very little real return as inflation went up. Now, in the low inflation environment, by the way, when I often say to folks, we could end up with a 6% return from stocks over the next decade if inflation stays low, they say, but gosh, that just sounds too low. I thought the historical average real return from stocks was close to 6%. And I'm saying it's going to be nominally 6 after that, because inflation today is 1 to 1.5%. So the real return I'm suggesting for stocks is close to 4%. The 6% long-term average real return from stocks includes over 4 percentage points from dividends. So what I'm really describing is we're starting it, that's because a lot of those long-term averages, like the Ibbotson series from 1926, that's in the annual book published by Morningstar, now Duff and Phelps, that series starts in 1926. So the long-term average return of 10% starts with PE, and that back in 1926, PE was 10.2. The only reason we all know long-term average stocks returns to be 10 is because those series often start with lower valuations that had higher dividend yield. So the 6% real nominal return, 4% real, is very consistent with historical returns, but it's consistent with historical returns that start in high valuation environments rather than in low or average valuation environments.
Okay, so that's a really good point that you just made, because I think what you're discussing is that a lot of the assumptions that are made in terms of average stock market returns are done. Those assumptions may be overly aggressive given when they were formed, and you have to take those with a grain of salt. Is that basically what you're saying, is those assumptions really don't apply to the current market?
The assumptions that relate to 100-year returns don't relate to 10-year outlooks. And certainly not in the current environment. Let me offer a couple of statistics just to help frame this. I think it's important to shift our paradigm about the way that returns are delivered by the market. So let's look back at every decade-long period since 1900. So 1900 to 1909, 1901 to 1910, 1902 to 11, etc. Okay, there have been over 100 of those 10-year periods that people have lived through. We're trying to get a sense for what's reasonable for the next 10 years. So let's look at all the past 10 years. And the average return is right at 10%. But no decade was exactly 10.000%. So let's use a range for what we consider average. And I want to be inclusive, so let's broaden that range. So 10's our middle point. Let's consider everything between 8 and 12 to be average. So if the decade had a compounded average return of more than 8 or less than 12, we'll call that average. If it's more than 12, it's above average. If it's less than 8, it's below average. What percent of the time do decade-long returns fall inside the average category? What I find in most groups is that most people assume that it happens about 80% of the time or more, because they assume the market's returns come in a bell-shaped curve. In reality, only 20% of the decades fell had returns between 8 and 12%. 80% of the time, it was either above average or below average. Well, it's much more of a barbell view of the market and the way it delivers decade-long returns, not a bell-shaped curve. Well, the reason that's important is because the odds-on bet is either another decade of above average, over 12, or below average, below 8. The one thing that above average group has in common is they start with below average valuations. And the below average group, you guessed it, they start with above average valuations, because valuation drives the ultimate level. And we're in the group, we're in the above average valuation level, and therefore much more likely to be in that 46% of the time of the decades that fell in the below 8% return range. So when you're putting together forecasts for the future, when you're doing Monte Carlo simulations, etc., the key is to consider relevant periods. I mean, that's exactly what Markowitz told us in modern portfolio theory. It comes in two stages, and the first stage is the assumptions, and that's your responsibility. Then he has a model to help you develop portfolios. So just one last analogy, because people often can relate to Chicago, and they say, with the weather in Chicago, the analogy I would offer is, if you're going to Chicago, and you come to me and you say, what's the weather like in Chicago and how should I pack? I'll tell you, if I give you the long-term view, I'll tell you, well, it's 65, pack for nice temperate weather. But the reality is, almost all the time in Chicago, it's either hot or cold. It's rarely 65. So what the first thing I should have said is, well, when are you going? Are you going to be going during a winter period or going during a summer period? And then use an average that relates to the period that you're going to be experiencing or when you're traveling. And investors today are setting out on a 10-year trek to Chicago in the markets. And the key is to recognize that we're starting out not with the aggregate of all of the last 100 years of history, but rather the periods that start with above-average valuations. We're not just above average. We're in the well into the top 10% of valuations, nearly the top 5% of valuations. So it is it's a very high degree of certainty, very high degree of certainty that we are set for well below average returns or worse.
So what you just laid out, it makes perfect sense, but yet it's amazing, because how many financial planners out there are constructing people's portfolios or conducting financial plans around what you're saying. Because from our experience, when we're doing financial planning with clients and with different people that call us to want to understand, you know, what should I be doing? And there are other advisors out there that will provide a more rosy outlook in terms of what they can expect from their portfolio. And what we find is in most cases, they're using a long-term average for stock market returns, as you just said, which can be very deceiving, especially if you're not considering where we are currently. Do you see the Financial Planning Committee taking what you just said, which is extremely important, and applying that to today's financial planning or to the needs of investors today?
It depends. There are a variety of investment advisors and planners that are out there. There are some that believe that the market's random. They think in terms of 100-year periods, just like the academics and just like a lot of the history we've described today. And those almost dismiss any kind of discussion like this because they see total randomness in the market, and therefore there's no reason to try to predict it short-term or long-term. So another group that I would say would hear a message like this and would be alarmed. They'd be worried about the fact that you're not going to get average returns and the implications. I think more and more, though, I find a growing set of advisors that find empowerment from this discussion. You see, all of a sudden, it moves you from being at the control of the market to being in control of your portfolio. Because if you recognize that we're set for an environment, it's like standing up in front of the 4-H club and telling them that we're getting ready to go to winter. And everybody can get all sad that the tomatoes and watermelons aren't going to grow in the winter. Or you can get empowered to go get the winter squash, to get the winter beet, or get squash, or get other plants that will work in that kind of environment. So the empowering part of this discussion is embodied in the advisors that go out and recognize the environment and then recognize that portfolios can be structured to meet this environment. When we were in the 80s and 90s, in my first book, Unexpected Returns, Chapter 10 was titled Row, Not Sail. And it used a boatsman metaphor to say that when we're in periods of secular bull markets like the 80s and 90s, with valuations rising and earnings growing, when you have those above average periods, just put out the sail and enjoy the ride. But in this environment, the sail's not going to work. We need to pull the sail down, pull the oars out, and row. And that's a much more active, diversified, risk-managed, and return-generating approach to a portfolio. And I think that that's why this discussion is empowering, is because a person can then look out and say, well, gosh, if we're going to be in this below-average return environment, what are the things that make sense? What are the offsetting types of investments should be included? And most of all, what this is empowering about is a lot of investors, when you offer them alternatives like master, and I'm not recommending any of these, I'm just throwing these out as examples, master limited partnerships, real estate investment trust, commodity funds, actively managed funds, option strategies, commodities, all kinds of things, they almost always go back and compare it to the long-term average return from stocks of 10% and say, oh, gosh, that REIT's only going to earn 6 or 7, that such and such investment's only going to be a 5 or a 6 with current cash flow. But if we're in an environment where stock returns are 5 or 6 at best and at great risk of being less, all of a sudden those alternatives not only hedge risk, they add return. And that all of a sudden becomes empowering for investors to be able to have portfolios that are much more driven by the so-called the tortoise and the hare, by the tortoise of much more consistent returns over time and less risk than to try to run at it like you would a secular bull market and make great returns from a market that won't provide them.
Ed, let's talk about the business cycle for a moment, because I do know that your research focuses pretty extensively on the business cycle, the drivers, what moves us out of recessions into recessions. Some of the things that we've been discussing with guests on our program, we've had a number of different people on giving their outlook for when the next recession is going to occur. And it seems that a large number of people are lining up for around the 2019 timeframe. So over a year, about a year and a half away now at this point, at least. We spoke to one interesting company in particular. They're named Intensity Corporation. They have a machine learning forecasting engine is how they referred to it. And by compiling all this data, they calculate in real time what the expected target date is for recession. They're lining up for 2019. Barry Bannister at Stifel Nicolaus, we spoke to him. When he looks at the interest rate cycle and the shadow funds rate, he was thinking that 2019 is a pretty likely time frame. And we've spoken to others, Alan Bollier at ITR Research, who also has been saying for years, I think as far back as 2014, that they're expecting a 2019 time frame for the next recession. I'm not going to put you on the spot and say, what is your outlook unless you want to? But let's talk about at least the business cycle in general and where you think we are. This economic expansion, we can definitely say, it's been running for quite a long time. Where does that put us in terms of records? And at which point does this become the longest expansion that we've ever seen?
Sure. And I think that's important to put things in context. It certainly doesn't predict when the next one will happen, but it certainly gives us an indication of what's reasonable from an historical perspective. They've been dating recessions and expansions since 1850, and so we have quite a long history, over 160 years, quite a number of decades. As of March, we became the third longest expansion on record, going back to 1850. If we make it to next April in 2018, we'll move into second place. And then I guess depending upon when it happens in 2019, according to your forecasters, if we make it to July of 2019 without a recession, then we become the longest expansion on record. But that isn't the last record to make. The next record to make occurs just a few months later, in January of 2020. Because in January of 2020, if we make it there without having a recession, then we will have had the first full calendar decade, the 2010s, that did not have a recession. So that helps to put in perspective just how common recessions are, that every decade, 1850s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, all the way through the 2000s, all had at least one recession. Matter of fact, we started having fewer recessions around the 1930s going forward. There were more of them. There were actually some 3 and 4 recession per decade decades before the 1930s. But since the 1930s, every decade has either had 1 or 2 recessions, and actually 2/3 of them had 2, not 1. So going through a decade with only 1 recession would be less common. Going through with none would be record-breaking, and obviously we'd be well on track to have the longest expansion and the first time without it. So will we make it that far? It's hard to say. One thing to keep in mind is that one thing about recessions is recessions often sort out disruptions and imbalances in economies. When economies are growing, and typical expansion grows at around 4% or more. And when you're growing that fast, things get out of line. And so you need a recession to sort of reset things. This expansion has averaged about 2% growth. So we've been in slow motion. So I guess one could say that we're due for a recession, but another might say, you know, we've been playing this game in slow motion so long that maybe we're further away from a recession than it seems. So I know it sounds like an economist to give you a on one hand and yet on the other hand forecast, but that's where I'd come down.
Yeah, well, as you noted, I mean, this expansion has been very slow. I think by some metrics, it's been the slowest on record that we've seen, and perhaps you can qualify that exactly. But essentially, as you just noted, that means that we don't see as many imbalances as we would otherwise if we were growing very quickly. Do you have any thoughts on where current imbalances might be at present? I think something that most people would point to is the stock market. When we look at valuations again, is that we see very elevated stock prices. Markets are overvalued once again, as we've been discussing. As you said earlier, we're well into the top 5 to 10% of valuations. So we're not at the tech bubble, but if things continue as they are, we could very well get there. So in that case, I mean, that's one place you could say that there's a potential imbalance. Any thoughts in terms of other places where you think an imbalance may be building or brewing? Other commentators have talked about commercial real estate. I mean, there's a lot of different things that I think we could look at, but do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, my sense is that it looks like in terms of the various proposals flying around Washington these days about changes in tax policy and changes in fiscal policy, changes in priorities. Now, I would say that we'll look back from the next recession, and the imbalances that we'll identify at that point may not have been knowable at this point, and they're more likely to be caused by all those changes that then suddenly, by virtue of the changes in tax policies and fiscal policies and priorities, well, then suddenly the conditions in certain areas will be out of balance with those new policies and those new approaches. So I don't have a sense right now on it. I think right now, even if you did identify an area that was out of balance, it could be back in balance when policies change. If nothing else, maybe that's the message that comes out of this discussion is we're getting ready to go through, for the last 8 years, we had a very similar policy set. Now, that 2% growth rate, let me just mention, so some people say, gosh, maybe that isn't too bad if we can avoid recessions by having slower growth. But the reality is, had we had an average expansion, today incomes and the economy would be 20% higher than they are today. So that slow growth has come at great cost to many families across this country. Matter of fact, even if you said that you could trade slower growth and expansions for no recessions, we'd need to be at 3% to have average growth. And even under that scenario, incomes and the economy would be 10% higher just over a decade. So this slow growth has come at quite a cost. It may not seem like it, but it's come at a great cost.
Well, that's a very good point because, again, I think the popularity of Trump speaks to that, the fact that incomes were not increasing for the average American for quite some time during this whole economic expansion. So there was a large group of individuals out there that were not seeing their incomes go up. They're not doing well under Obama, and so that clearly leads to a feeling of disenfranchisement. They're not being helped by the current administration. And so, you know, Trump was an answer to that. And I guess at this point, the question is whether or not we're going to see that jump in economic growth that Trump anticipates if his policy proposals get through that others hopefully are wanting to see in terms of reduction in taxes and a lot of other things. But that's still, I think that's up in the air, and there's not a lot of indication in terms of how quickly some of those things are going to come through. And yeah, as many have said, you know, if we don't see some of those policies implemented quickly, then that might end up leading to a reduction in the market given how high confidence levels are by investors, by small businesses and others in anticipating those things.
Absolutely. I think if you look at, and this is obviously we're having an economic discussion, not a political discussion, from an economic perspective, Trump ran on a series of policies, tax cuts, pro-growth, et cetera, pro-productivity, put workers back to work, et cetera, that was intended to be a boost to the economy. And naturally, if it's a boost to the economy, that would be a boost to corporate sales and corporate profits, and therefore should be a boost to the stock market. What's happened is the market's rallied strongly since he was elected, in expecting those changes to be implemented. It's probably gotten a bit ahead of itself in terms of valuations. And it is at a level that's unsustainable. But at the same time, I think if very few of those policies ultimately get implemented, then obviously a lot of the market's run over the past 6 months or 9 months will have been in vain. And that would leave us more than just a little overvalued.
If you wouldn't mind, tell our listeners a little bit more about Crestmont Research, some of the reports that you do produce, and the best way that they can get their hands on them.
Absolutely. Well, CrestmontResearch.com is an open access website. There are no banner ads or subscriptions. Investors and investment advisors are welcome to go. You'll find there are a lot of color charts and graphs and some articles that help describe and explain a lot of things we've talked about today. One in particular that I recommend, if you go to the top right-hand side of any page, there's a search bar. And just search for Waiting for Average. Waiting for Average is a short article that will go into a description of the three components and why from here we should be expecting the below average returns and why average is unrealistic. Beyond that, if people like the information, I'm a market climatologist, not a market weather forecaster. So updates to the website occur once or twice a quarter. There's no weekly newsletter or monthly update. In the short run, a lot of stuff happens, but the stuff that I'm really focused on is that investor horizon of 5, 10, and 20 years, not the short-term forecast of the next day or week or month or year. But if people want an update to a notice, it's an email that basically describes the updates, the implications of the update, and then links to those updates. There's a place in that upper right-hand side of the webpage. There's no charge. It's a complimentary service, and the email address is not used for any other purpose. Crestmont Research doesn't have ads and doesn't have subscriptions. And for somebody who's really excited about this stuff, in the books and videos section, you'll find a video series that goes into the highlights from unexpected returns and some additional details. And there's a trailer, an 8-minute trailer that a person can watch to get a sense on whether they want to invest the time in the 6-part series. But I assure you it's very accessible in terms of the level of content for any reader or any viewer that would be interested in the concepts behind unexpected returns. So CrestmontResearch.com, CrestMont, research.com. And thanks for the chance to offer that up, Chris, and to share perspectives. I hope it's been thought-provoking and empowering for your listeners.
Well, it certainly was. And I want to note, we will have a link to your website where this interview is located. For those that are on the Financial Sense website, you can click Crestmont Research there. And then we'll also have a link out to the Waiting for Average article that you just mentioned. It's subtitled Why the Long-Term Average Will Never Occur for Today's Investors. And that covers a bit of what we discussed on the tail end of today's interview. So I do want to encourage many of you to read that. Ed, it was a pleasure having you on our program. Keep up the great work.
Thanks, Chris. All the best.
So again, that was Eddie Easterling. He's founder and president of Crestmont Research. And I hope many of you take what he said today to heart, because when you have these high market valuations, as we see currently, again, if you look at the average of the four valuation indicators provided by Doug Short, which uses the Crestmont PE ratio provided by Ed, we are the second most expensive in recorded history going back to the 1900s. And as Ed laid out in this interview, as an investor, when you're considering the expected market returns going forward over the next next 10 years, these high market valuations mean there's a very high degree of certainty, Ed said, that we are going to see below average returns. So you have to be aware of the assumptions that are being used, whether or not it's coming from a financial planner, since that will dictate a lot of the figures that you're presented with regards to how much you can draw down from your principal or from income. All of this is based on the assumptions. And you know, one caveat that we should probably make in this discussion is timing. His research is based on probabilities and it's looking at the facts. Making specific time predictions is difficult. As we discussed, we have had a number of forecasters on that believe looking at the data, probably the best projection we can make is for a U.S. recession to occur in the 2019 timeframe. But putting that aside, the main message is, of course, that when you look at a long-term time horizon, 10 years or so from current market valuations, that does mean that we should expect lower returns. And he said, you know, in a low inflation environment, that's pretty much a hibernating bear with a real return of 4% compounded annual return over the next 10 years. If we see higher inflation, then we're looking at probably returns of 0% over the next 10 years. So this is not a timing issue. This does not mean from this point we will see that take place. As he noted, there is the possibility that we could see the market climb closer to the valuations that we saw in the 2000s. Now, that might be a stretch because the tech bubble was such an anomaly. We've never seen valuations that high, and capital was just flooding into the U.S. based on this euphoric belief that we were going to see the internet change everything. There was this idea floating around of the new economy. Of course, valuations were just going through the roof with companies making no money, and it was based on clicks. So getting back to that would mean a euphoria of the highest amount. And what would lead to that euphoria is hard to say. And it's hard to believe that we would get to that point. But we very well could. We could see over the next year or 2 years us matching the 2000 tech bubble before eventually seeing that long-awaited expected bear market, a mean reversion of very highly priced stocks. So it's hard to make predictions in terms of the timing point. And I think that's the one thing that we do have to keep in mind. But overall, consider the assumptions that are being made. Consider the assumptions that people are telling you. If you have a financial planner discussing to you, you know, what you should expect in terms of historical stock market return, pass to them Ed Easterling's work from Crestmont Research. Have them consider it and ask them whether or not this would change how you are currently allocated based on this information. I think that these are things that we need to be asking. These are things that we need to be looking at because assumptions, again, can be very deceiving, especially if you're looking at them over a 100-year period. I'm Chris Sheridan. You're listening to FS Insider at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at FinancialSense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Mike Roberts is a software development engineer at Amazon, and he's just created the world's first cooperative multiplayer stock market game called StockStream. It's actually available on Twitch, and Mike joins us today to talk about this revolutionary experiment. If you haven't heard about it, you're going to want to pay attention because it's very interesting. Mike, basically, you have gamified stock market trading, and you've provided $50,000 of your own money, let's call it seed capital, for this new business venture, if you want to call it that, for people to play with. And it's anonymous users. I think there's thousands of different people that can play. But tell us a little bit about how it works and what are the results so far.
Sure, you're right. It's basically just gamifying the stock market. And the way that it works is, you know, I have a server set up in my condo right now, and there's this piece of software that I wrote that will read what people are typing into the Twitch chat. So if you go to the StockStream Twitch channel, you'll see people are typing these buy and sell commands into the Twitch chat. And what my software does is it divides this game into rounds. Right now, I've set the rounds to be 5 minutes long. And so every round, you know, every 5 minutes, it just takes all the different votes votes to buy or sell different stocks. At the end of the round, it just finds the top most voted command. We'll just execute that trade automatically. I use the Robinhood brokerage. I think it's called Robinhood.com to do the trading. The advantage of that is that there are zero fees. So with all this day trading, it doesn't get eaten up by all the fees. And if you look at the video, part of this piece of software that I've built loads up all this data about the portfolio. It will load recent quotes, different news items, just display them in this sort of 8-bit interface that I've created just to make it look like a video game.
My guest this week is A. Gary Schilling, who's editor-in-chief of his newsletter, Insight, and author of the book, The Age of Deleveraging, Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation. Gary, I want to go back to something that we've seen over the last 8 years, and that's a tremendous amount of monetary stimulus, both by our Fed, by the ECB in Japan. And Gary, it has done very little in terms of economic growth. In fact, most of the growth has taken place in the stock market. But as you have pointed out in your recent insight, stocks are primarily owned by high income and upper net worth people who don't adjust their borrowing and spending appreciably as their portfolios rise and fall. In contrast, most Americans have had declining purchasing power. So, you know, the Fed has talked about, and sometimes politicians have talked about, gee, look at our policies and look at the stock market today. It's been called the Trump rally. Before that, we had the Obama bull market in stocks, but it hasn't translated into, you know, the average guy in the street hasn't seen that.
No, that's absolutely true. And, you know, monetary policy is a very blunt instrument. Central banks can raise and lower interest rates. They can buy and sell securities, and that's it. They can't have a direct impact on the economy, at least the way they're set up in major countries. In other words, it's very different in fiscal policy. If there's a desire to help the unemployed, they can increase unemployment benefits, put money directly into people's hands. You can't do that with monetary policy. So what has happened? The Fed and other central banks have been very stimulative. They knocked their reference rate, Fed funds rate in this country, down to essentially zero in response to the Great Recession and the financial crisis. But that didn't have much effect because the creditworthy borrowers had plenty of money and banks didn't want to lend to the rest. Well, then they went into this quantitative easing that you, in effect, were citing, where they were buying all these securities, pumping money into the economy. But you're absolutely right, because what happens is those securities that they bought, treasuries, also mortgage-related securities, they were owned by financial institutions or high-net-worth individuals. Now, financial institutions, and what did they do with that money? They sold those to the government. They used the money. They, in effect, reinvested it in equities. And I think that's what basically drove up equities starting in March of 2009. It was entirely the Fed. It wasn't the economy. The economy was limping along. Well, okay, those equity portfolios go up, but as you cite, upscale individuals are not going to change their spending that much. I mean, some guy's got, he's got four cars in the driveway, hasn't got room for a fifth, his portfolio goes up. They just don't do that much. As far as financial institutions, you know, a portfolio of a pension funds goes up or a trust company or so on, they don't change their individual spending that much. They're on their own bricks and mortar, furniture, whatever. So you get very little effect from this. The Fed really just doesn't have the ability to spur the economy directly. They assume, the central banks assume, that if you get interest rates low enough, that that will induce people to borrow. And that does make sense in a classic economic sense, but it doesn't when you've got all these other factors that are inhibiting people to borrow. And one of the most interesting experiments we've had is in Japan, in Europe, the European Central Bank, where they have reduced interest rates below zero. They've actually said, we're going to penalize banks and individuals for holding money. We're going to charge them for the privilege, and that will encourage them to spend it to turn it over. Well, it's had the reverse effects, particularly in Japan. What happened? People get negative interest rates, and they say, boy, I got to save more to be able to retire, not borrow and spend more. They're saving more, the opposite effects. Now, the Federal Reserve, I think, quite by design, in effect said, we're going to sit back. We're going to let the Europeans and the Japanese experiment. We'll let them be the guinea pigs. And, of course, I think they're very happy that they did, because it has really had the opposite effects of what they wanted. So monetary policy, and I've said this many times, written about it, is impotent. It basically is at this stage in the cycle. Yeah, when they want to tighten up, they can make credit less available, push interest rates through the roof. They have effects on the upside. You know, this is the old argument. They used to call it pushing on a string. When you pull on a string, you tighten it, you get results. When you push on a string, it just goes limp. Not much happens.
I want to turn our topic once again back to debt, this time government debt. And this was rather controversial. There was a best-selling book by Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff. It was called This Time It's Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. And they talk about when levels approach 90%, which the U.S. has already passed, it impedes economic growth rates, and that is being used as an explanation of the reason that we've seen this economy stuck in this 2% growth rate. I wonder if you might take on that argument and show how it may not necessarily apply factually to the United States.
Yeah, well, actually, in our June newsletter, we've got an article called Debt and Finance, really address that explicitly. What happened, as you say, they did have this argument that when government debt to GDP, which is the sum of all goods and services produced in the economy, when it gets to 90%, economic growth disappears, and boy, it's the end of the world. Well, as it turns out, they had made some miscalculations, and they did not include a bunch of debt, and it's kind of a chuckle in the economics fraternity, because here are the two various esteemed Harvard professors, and they got tripped up by a lowly graduate student at the University of Massachusetts who made the calculations and realized that they had mislaid a lot of that, of the important data. And as a result, their argument was really just didn't hold water. And of course, we've seen that ever since. I mean, the government debt in this country, it's about 80% of GDP, federal government debt. And that's the net debt in the hands of the public. We throw out the debt, which is one government agency lending to another. I mean, I don't want to get too esoteric about this, but when government collects Social Security payments from you and me and everybody else, the Social Security Administration sends that to the Treasury, and the Treasury issues them an actual government bond. But that's an intergovernment transfer. It doesn't really have anything to do with the markets and so on. So we exclude that. But in any event, we're about 80%. We didn't get to 90%. But the point is that this has not really been an effective argument. We look back and look back at the point at which the interest on the government debt was the highest it ever was, and that was back in the 70s. And that did not upset the apple cart. And we say, what would it take to get there? Because you see, the whole argument here is this debt bomb. It's the idea that government debt gets to the point that the interest on that debt becomes a huge chunk of the deficit, the year-by-year deficit, and that adds to the debt, and the whole thing then grows asymptotically. Well, we didn't get there in the 70s, and of course now with low interest rates, we're way below where we were then. To get back to where we were in the 70s, which was the highest interest on the federal debt in relation to the economy, you'd have to get back to government interest costs of about 8%, and they're now like about 2%. Now, that could happen. But you'd have to have a tremendous amount of inflation to get there, or a complete breakdown in confidence in U.S. Treasury obligations. And boy, that would be a pretty tough world either way.
You know, I want to talk about something that you also relate to this idea of government debt, and it's something the Trump administration has been pushing forth and when it was running for office, and now since he's assumed the presidency, and that's economic growth is one of the best elixirs for getting rid of government debt, because it does a number of things. It raises tax revenues, because if the economy is growing at a faster rate, that means more people are working, corporations are making profits. Secondly, if the economy is growing faster, that means the entitlements come down because there's less people on welfare. They're now employed. So let's talk about this concept of faster economic growth. You believe that we are 2 to 3 years away from that. Explain, number one, why you think we're 2 to 3 years away. And then secondly, why that's the best elixir for fixing government deficit problems.
Well, in terms of 2 to 3 years away, this is the whole idea. It'll take that length of time to get the fiscal stimulus really enacted, and the money spent, and higher incomes and people spending it, and more investment, because you'll have higher capacity utilization rates and so on. That's just the length of time I think it'll take. But the second point there, Jim, growth covers a multitude of sins. I mean, there's nothing like economic growth. For example, if you look at government debt as a relation to GDP, and you have to look at debt or almost anything else in relation to something. I mean, you cited earlier that consumer borrowing, basically back to where we were at the peak in the 70s. Yeah, but the economy's grown since then. if you look at total consumer debt, and this is mortgage debt, student debt, auto loans, credit cards, et cetera, if you look at that in relation to after-tax income, that hit a high of 130%. It's now back to 95%. Now, it's a long way from the norm of 65%, but it has come down. You have to look at the denominator. If you look at government debt in relation to GDP, that during World War II got to 135%. It dropped down to 40%. Now, there was very little debt repaid, or only a couple of years in the whole post-World War II period when the government ran a surplus and they were retiring debt. It was basically economic growth. And so economic growth, for the reasons you cited, reduces welfare payments. It means people are pushed into higher tax brackets, more corporate income taxes paid, but also as a denominator to debt, it pushes down the ratio. So economic growth is very important, and obviously we have not had appreciable growth really since 2007.
So as we take a look at this, you think we're still likely to remain in this 2% range going forward, and it may take 2 or 3 years before any stimulus, whether it's tax or infrastructure spending, but you believe that's coming regardless of what both parties are saying against each other.
Yes, I do. And matter of fact, in this book you cited, The Age of Deleveraging, I wrote that in 2010. And that book forecast 2% growth until this whole deleveraging and working off the excesses was taken care of. Well, it's averaged 2.1% since then, so pretty much on what I forecast. And I think that will continue for the next couple of years.
So as you see this unfolding, this slow growth period of time that we have, and then also maybe restrictions on consumer spending, especially as the boomers age and head into retirement, let's talk about the investment implications for that. Because clearly stocks have done very well over the last 9 years, although I'd like to hear your comments, Gary, when you see companies like Amazon and Alphabet over $1,000 a share. You see valuations that I haven't seen since internet days, with a lot of money going into these stocks being fed by these passive indexing funds. What are the investment implications for this cycle that you see remaining in place, at least for the next couple of years?
Well, stocks are not cheap. You look at them in relation to prices, in relation to earnings, they're way above average. If you look at it on this trend-adjusted 10-year basis that Bob Shiller, professor at Yale, has put together, their stocks adapt to decline about 40% to get back to the long-term trends. And then the earnings to which those earnings, those prices are related, have been really based on cost-cutting. You haven't had revenue growth for companies because you've had slow real economic growth and very little inflation, so they have no pricing power. So what has propelled earnings has been cost-cutting. Well, most of those costs are directly or indirectly labor costs, and that's one of the reasons that we've had this miserable performance in wages for over a decade. So you don't really have a very sound situation there. Well, you say, okay, how long can this last? Well, a couple of points. One is bull markets and stocks, at least in recent decades, have not died of old age. They've died from one or two reasons. One is the Federal Reserve gets very concerned about an overheating economy. They jack up interest rates to the point they kill it. And by my reckoning, in 11 of 12 times when they've really just tried to say, we're going to cool off the economy, we don't want to upset the apple cart, they've gotten a recession. Only one so-called soft landing was in the mid-90s. Now, I don't think Fed is yet in that position. They are moving very, very cautiously. I think it would take a number of years and a lot faster economic growth before they did that. So that brings you to the second ending of bull markets, and that's a shock of some kind. We saw that at the end of the 1990s when the dot-com excesses collapsed, and then, of course, in the mid-2000s when subprime mortgages really just that huge debacle. Jim, I spent a career looking for bubbles and picked up a number of them, but I don't see anything that ranks with those two in the offing. Yeah, you can say oil price collapse, and I think oil prices are going a lot lower. You can say a blow up in the Middle East, prices go through the roof. You can have a debt crisis in China. You can conjure up something, but there isn't an excess there that's just cruising for a bruising waiting to happen. So I'd say at the moment, you sort of say, well, stocks are expensive. They don't make much sense at these levels. You'd have to have a lot of years of very slow growth in stocks to sort of bring you back to normal levels on price-earnings ratios. You'd have to have a lot more solidly based earnings to do the job. But having said that, I don't see what's going to upset the apple carts. What we do in portfolios we manage, we just take a very cautious approach. We're just not out there swinging for the fences. I mean, tech stocks have had a big run. And, you know, part of this is this argument, money has no place else to go. Well, boy, you know and I know historically when people make that conclusion, when the only reason they can conjure up to buy anything, stocks or anything else, is money has no place else to go. That usually is not a very solid base, and it usually is not very sustainable. So I think you've got to be very cautious right now on stocks. By the same token, I think we're now seeing with the end of the Trump trade, people realizing it's going to take a lot longer. You're not going to have this flooding of the market with treasuries to finance big fiscal stimulus immediately. You know, I've been a fan on long-term treasury bonds since 1981 when the yield was 15.2%. Now it's down to 3%. I think it could go to 2% on the 30-year bond and 1% on the 10-year treasury note. I think that's a good area. I think commodities are probably going to continue to be weak, particularly oil. Dollar has gotten beat up since the initial Trump rally, but long term, I think the dollar will probably be strong as a safe haven. But it's not an environment where I think you can really just and mindlessly buy stocks. And of course, that's what happened recently when you've had all the passive investment, the index funds. And yeah, the statistics show long term, and this is just logic. You know, so much of stocks are owned by institutions. And for every buyer, there's a seller. For every winner, there's a loser. So on balance, they're going to perform about in step with the market, and they actually underperform the extent of their fees. I mean, that's just simple math. Of course, everybody's looking for the manager, or including themselves, is going to beat the market. That's the reason people go to Las Vegas. The statistics tell them they're going to lose money, but they go anyway. It's the inherent gambling instinct of human beings, I guess. But the point is that I think in this environment, one has to be cautious. And, you know, you've had this huge interest. You look at NASDAQ, you take out a few of the high flyers and you don't have the performance. I think you're getting more and more this feeling of you can buy anything, they're all going up, this passive investment. I think it's overdone. I think we're probably going to see a swing back to active management, and maybe it'll take a big market decline to convince people that you just can't buy the indexes and leave for Hongo Bongo for 6 years.
You know, one of the things that you try to do in your newsletter, as you talk about themes and various things that are happening in the economy, you try to turn that into sort of investment implications. And I want to go through 10 themes that you have, and if you could just comment briefly. One, a robust dollar. Two, rising U.S. Treasury prices, which implies 2% yield for the 30-year bond, 1% for the 10-year note, which is the opposite of what Wall Street's expecting, following commodity prices, uncertainty in the equity markets. Then you also talk about various things like various trends that are more cautious in nature. Let's bring that down to, because the Fed is going to meet this month, where it's widely expected they will raise interest rates for the third time in less than 12 months. And speculation is they'll go again before the end of the year. But as I look at some of these economic numbers, whether it's consumer confidence not translating into consumer spending, Gary, some of the weakness in the ISM service numbers and manufacturing numbers, do you believe they will be as aggressive? And especially if there's talk about unwinding the balance sheet, which would be basically withdrawing liquidity from the market.
They've been cautious so far. As a matter of fact, if you look back throughout this whole expansion, the Fed has been overly optimistic on economic growth, been expecting a lot more inflation they've had, have been perennially saying they're going to raise rates next year, and they keep postponing. I don't know why they don't just stop trying to forecast. Their record is pretty miserable. But in any event, they may raise rates once or twice more this year, but I think they're going to do it very, very cautiously. They realize the economy is not on that solid a footing. We talked about employment. I mean, where the jobs created are not the high-paid jobs or the low-paid jobs. Consumers are cautious, etc. But even when they do raise rates, one of the things that our research shows, and we've pointed this out an article in our June report called Fed Influence on Treasury Bonds. If you look at the entire post-war period and work through the analysis, which we do in detail, if the Federal Reserve raises their reference rate, the federal funds rate, the overnight rate, if they raise it by 100 basis points on average, that would spill over to 46 basis points, 0.46% increase in 10-year Treasury note yields and 35 basis point increase in long-term Treasury bond yields, 30-year bond yields. In other words, there's not much of a spillover, and a lot of that may be already discounted because of what the Fed's been talking about, raising rates for years. So I'm not too concerned. I think the Fed's going to be very cautious, and even if they do move further, I think a lot of it's already discounted, and it isn't a big spillover effect anyway, at least on average in the entire post-World War II period.
And let's talk about if there's anything out there right now that would give you cause for concern. Like you said, you're a bit cautious here. Your portfolios are defensive. You've got quite a bit of cash. If you were looking for something that would be more ominous in terms of the economy and the financial markets, Gary, what would that be?
It would be a shock. I mentioned earlier, I don't think the Fed is going to raise rates rapidly enough to upset the apple cart. They may do that once we get into this massive fiscal stimuli, but that's, I think, 2 or 3 years down the road. So in the meanwhile, I think what I'm looking for is some kind of shock. And you don't have these big imbalances like we had with dot-com stocks in the late 1990s or the subprime mortgage excesses of the mid-2000s. You don't have those that are just crying for correction. But that doesn't mean you couldn't get a shock. And the slower the economic growth, the easier it is for a shock to upset the apple cart, to drive growth into negative territory, and that's recession. And that invariably involves a bear market in stocks. So it's really a question of saying what shocks are possible. Now, I've talked extensively. You know, I'm on record as saying we could see $10 to $20 a barrel on oil prices, and they are now declining. It doesn't look like OPEC is going to pull it off. They were hoping to scare out the American frackers by flooding the market with oil. That was their decision back in November 2014. They're playing this elaborate game of chicken. Well, guess who chickened out? It was OPEC. They were really trying to force somebody else. They got tired of being the swing producer, of maintaining the cartel price by cutting their own production because everybody else was cheating against them. But I don't think they're going to be successful. And the thing about lower oil prices, it's a two-edged sword because, yes, lower oil prices help the U.S. We're still a net importer of energy. And the same is true of Western Europe, Japan, and China. But there's a lot of investment in the energy area, and lower oil prices, as we saw when they collapsed really after November 2014, that creates a lot of bankruptcies and so on, particularly in the thinly capitalized medium and smaller size energy companies, and that could be very, very disruptive. If I had to say what makes you really worry, I think that's probably the biggest one. It's this two-edged sword. Lower oil prices are a boon to oil users, including the U.S. on balance, but financially, they could create a lot of problems.
Gary, as we close, you've been following these markets for a long time, and you've had some great calls, especially I remember reading your first book at the beginning of the 80s, Deflation Ready or Not. Do you see this trend of deflation that we've been sort of in, and especially now with we're seeing acceleration in technology, which is disruptive from the internet, from the Amazons of the world to the Ubers to the Airbnb? What do you see unfolding? Do you see this deflationary period lasting for a longer period? Or do you see in 2 or 3 years from now when the government stimulus kicks in with infrastructure that we might move from a period of, let's say, deflation or disinflation to a period of inflation?
That certainly is possible, Jim. I mean, we have looked back at inflation in the U.S. found data going back to 1749. I'm not too sure about 1748, but from 1749 on, if we separate all those years, either wartime or peacetime, what you find is that in wartime, wholesale prices rose on average 8.2% per year. But in peacetime, they declined 0.5% a year. Now, what's going on there? Well, wars are times when government is spending a lot of money on top of a fully employed economy. They're borrowing to do so. They're putting a lot of pressure on productive capability. You get more demand and supply prices go up. In peacetime, however, there's enough productivity that the tendency is actual deflation, 0.5% a year on average. Now, of course, then you say, are we in wartime or peacetime? I think we're probably in peacetime. Yeah, we're still involved in the Middle East. There could be other flare-ups. But I think barring a big push one way or the other, and military spending in the past has been the cause of that, you've had deflation. Now, this comes back to your point about fiscal stimuli, however. If we have huge fiscal stimuli, really match what we've had in shooting wars in the past, sure, we could create so much demand pressure in the economy that we would revert to inflation. I kind of doubt that's going to happen, but that's a judgment call. That's the kind of thing you get into in World War One, the Civil War, World War Two. It takes a major, major military situation to create that kind of excess demand and inflation.
Any final thoughts, Gary, as you look at the final 6 months of this year and what it might look like?
Well, I think there's going to be continuing frustration with slow economic growth. And as we approach next year, the election year, by election, I think this will intensify and there'll be a lot more pressure on Washington to do something because people are now, they've come off, and you know, I wrote about this, Jim, you remember back in our December newsletter, which was the first one published after the November election, and I said, hey, wait a minute, this Trump trade, this expectation of instant rapid economic growth and deregulation, replacement for Obamacare, all these things just weren't going to happen. And now we're seeing that not only play out because of the time it takes to get through Congress, but Trump has got enough other problems with Russia and so on, and he doesn't have as many friends in Congress as it would take to get these things through anyway. So I think we're going to see continuing frustration because there just isn't the makings of rapid economic growth in the next 6 months anyway, or next 16 months for that matter, at least in my judgment. So there's going to be continuing pressure, and again, I think it will be interesting to see what they come up with in Washington to try to in effect promise people that rapid economic growth is right around the corner. Well, I think that's what Herbert Hoover said. Prosperity is just right around the corner during the Great Depression, and we know what happened to him in the 1932 election.
Well, finally, Gary, I want to talk a little bit about your monthly Insight newsletter, which is one of my favorites. I read it every single month. It's usually 30 to 40 pages. It covers the economy, and you really get into depth of some of the key economic indicators. I thought it was coincidental, the front cover of this month's June Insight, and then the article on Barron's this week. But you also talk about financial trends and sort of warning dangers. You were one of the early voices on the housing crisis and the possible debt crisis coming up, and then you put that together with some themes. So if our listeners would like to find out more about your newsletter, why don't you tell them two ways they could do so, either by phone or by email or web?
Yeah, well, one is you can email us for information on this, and the email address is insight, I-N-S-I-G-H-T, at, and then all one word, agaryshilling.com, agaryshilling.com. And by the way, there's no C in shilling, it's S-H. And the other way is that people can call our toll-free number. It's 1-888-346-7444. And we can give you the information, and if somebody would like a sample copy, we'd be delighted to send you a complimentary version of our latest newsletter.
Well, let me give out that number. Once again, that's 1-888-346-7444. And the website is A. Gary Shilling. That's agaryshilling.com. Gary, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. It's always great speaking with you.
My pleasure. You're a great interviewer, Jim. You're one of the best. And I always look forward to the calls. You got great questions and you do your homework, and that's very commendable. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and you have yourself a great summer.
Okay. Be talking to you later.
So that concludes our first half of Jim Poplava's interview with Gary Shilling. Be sure to listen to the second half, which is going to be airing on Saturday as part of our Big Picture program. I'm Chris Sheridan. You're listening to FS Insider at FinancialSense.com.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.